Welcome to Intersections, the Brookings podcast, where we bring two experts together to discuss the angles on a policy issue. I'm here today with Ken Pollack and Shadi Hamid, two senior fellows with our Center for Middle East Policy. They're both prolific writers on issues from U.S. military and security interests in the Middle East to the shape of Islamic democracy in the Middle East. And I strongly encourage our listeners to go to brookings.edu to find many of their both longer and shorter pieces. Shadi is also the author of a brand new book, Islamic Exceptionalism, How the Struggle Over Islam is Reshaping the World. So, gentlemen, thank you both for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
The Middle East is in turmoil across the length and breadth of it. Outright civil war in some countries, political and economic instability in others. Ken, you wrote, it hasn't been this bad since the 13th century, which for our listeners who are a little fuzzy on their medieval history is when the Mongols rolled across a place and sacked Baghdad and generally saw an end to the Islamic Golden Age. Syria is the country that is the most in the news and what most of our listeners are probably the most experienced with. But perhaps you both can start with a brief preface on what else is going on in the region.
I'll take a shot at starting. I think we have to think about a couple of broad patterns that have been going on for a while that both Shadi and I have been writing about for some time. The first one I'd point to has been the collapse of the Arab state system that emerged after the Second World War when the Arab states acquired real independence, not the nominal independence they acquired under the colonial powers before World War II. At that time, they built a system based more or less on political autocracy, oil-based economies, whether they pumped it themselves or got aid, trade, and remittances from the oil-producing states, and a pretty traditional social structure. And, you know, it's a system that never was great, but it clunked along for 30 or 40 years. But what we've seen in the last 20, 30 years is it's really underperforming badly, and it is leaving a great many people in the region deeply frustrated. And of course, this all culminated in 2011 with the Arab Spring revolts, where people all across the region stood up and said, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And it led to the fall of a number of governments. But with it also came a second set of problems, which have now taken on a force of their own in the region, which is that in many of these countries, while the people could agree that they wanted the end of the existing regimes, they couldn't agree on what to replace it with. And so in Syria, in Libya, in Yemen, we had failed states. And those failed states, as they always do, turned into security vacuums, which then led to civil wars. And those civil wars are a second engine of instability all across the region. And as these civil wars do, they throw off all kinds of spillover. And part of the spillover often is that they can push other countries into civil war. So the civil war in Syria helped push Iraq back into civil war. Syria and Iraq are now creating all kinds of problems and potentially pushing Turkey into civil war. Syria and Libya are helping to create problems in Egypt, particularly in both the Western Desert and the Sinai, that you could arguably say is another civil war. They're creating instability in Lebanon, in Jordan. And so it's the set of different issues that really lie at the heart of things. And of course, what's, I think, often frustrating for folks like us is what the newspapers report on, the refugees, the terrorism, the radicalization. These are huge problems, but they are ultimately the spillover, the manifestation of these deeper problems.
Yeah, so Ken's given an excellent overview of everything that's gone wrong and will probably continue going wrong for quite some time. And it's sort of, it just made me sad listening to Ken.
Sorry, Sean.
But I have to say, you know, it has been, you know, having lived about six of the last 12 years in the Middle East, it's really been sad to watch how things seem to keep on getting worse. So I was in Tahrir Square the day that Mubarak fell, February 11th, 2011. It was a beautiful moment. And I remember people dancing in the streets. And right there in the square, the cheers just... people at first couldn't realize it, but then they realized what had just happened. And to see how things have changed so quickly from that moment to the extent where even thinking about that day, it's become blurry to me. Wait, did that really happen, right? So I think part of it, a very important part of it, is what Ken said, that, you know, it's easy to be united against an autocrat. The problem is when you have to decide what to put in the place of that autocrat. And one thing that I have looked very closely at is the ideological divide between what we might call Islamists and non-Islamists. A bit of an oversimplification, but those are two camps and various shades in between. And these different groups have fundamentally different visions of what the state is and what it should be. And they weren't able to agree at that very critical period in several of these countries, Egypt in particular, on what the constitution should look like. So I think for as Americans, when we talk about our own politics, a lot of it is about policy in the sense of, oh, gun control, universal health care, tax policy, things like that. But what we saw with the Arab Spring was that people were debating almost metaphysical issues, the meaning, nature, and purpose of the nation state. And it's very difficult to have a reasoned conversation about something that is metaphysical. It's intangible. How do you measure what the nation state is or what it should be? And I think a big part of that is the role of religion in public life, which again is a very raw and existential thing for people because it relates to how they live on a daily basis.
Sure. I guess one of the issues they faced in Libya was that there was no civil society after Gaddafi, but in Egypt there had been some of the structure was there. Can you talk a little bit more about the difficulties that Egypt saw with, given that there was a civil society there that existed, what were some of the problems they encountered?
Yeah, I mean, so what's so disturbing is that Egypt actually had quite a bit going for it in the sense that you don't have a Sunni-Shia divide. It is relatively homogenous, 90% Sunni Muslim. There is also a sense of stateness. There is an idea of Egyptianness and. Islamists and secularists and liberals feel there's a certain pride in being Egyptian, which you don't necessarily see in some other countries where national identity isn't as well formed. But you know, despite all of that, and despite having thousands of civil society organizations, of having at least some political parties, that wasn't enough. And that's what makes it hard to be optimistic, is that if it can't work in Egypt, then where can it really work? I guess the answer to that would be Tunisia as the only case where it seems to be going relatively well. But and also I think one thing that really struck me in Egypt is that you think also the more people spend time with each other and debate political issues, including in parliament and state institutions, they form coalitions with each other. And there had been some of that in the latter period of the Mubarak era. There was quite a bit of that in Tahrir Square in those early moments where people were cooperating and working together. But the more groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and liberals spend time with each other, the more they realized, hey, we really don't like each other. So it's not necessarily the case that the more you spend time with people you don't like, the more you close the gaps.
True. Ken, can you talk to us a little bit about Libya and Yemen in particular, again, as two of the lesser focused on civil war regions?
Yeah, and, you know, I think this is an important point, Trina, because there's this tendency to look at Iraq and say, well, Iraq has oil. We need to pay attention to them. I think that's true. There's a tendency to look at Syria and say, well, you know, Syria is causing all of these refugees and terrorism. We need to look at them. That's also true. And there's been this tendency, Yemen, Libya, they're just not as important. Libya was an important oil producer, never as important as Iraq, say, but nevertheless an important oil producer. But there's just been this tendency to say, well, these are just kind of places on the map. The problem with that logic is that these are now states in civil war. And we have a lot of experience with civil wars. There have been about 150 civil wars over the last 100 years, and we know a lot about them. And one of the biggest problems with them is, first, they don't often end by themselves, and oftentimes they don't end quickly. You should remember, you know, we have civil wars raging around the world that have gone on for 30, 35, even 40 years. And second, they create spillover. Right? They create refugees, terrorism, radicalization, secessionism, economic problems, and they suck in the neighbors. And they destabilize the neighbors. And, you know, we start out with this transition that I started talking about, a region in search of itself. and in search of itself in the fundamental ways that Shadi talked about. You know, who are we? What is the nature of our state? What is the relationship between our state and religion? I mean, absolutely fundamental, foundational issues. And into that mix, you throw these civil wars, which are generating all manner of spillover, right? And it is enormously dangerous. And people look at Libya and they look at Yemen and say, well, you know, what could they possibly do? Well, the problem is we've already seen that Libya is destabilizing Egypt. And as Shadi pointed out, Egypt is critical. A quarter of all Arabs are Egyptian. Whither Egypt goes the Arab world. And Libya is destabilizing Egypt. And Libya is next to Tunisia. And as Shadi pointed out, you know, Tunisia is the kind of bright, shining example that we all have, that we're all clinging to, of what an Arab democracy might look like. And I will point out that that's in part because none of us wants to pay any attention to Iraq, which we tend to regard as this kind of mistake, as opposed to a country that's also struggling with democracy. But of course, Iraq is in a state of civil war, and it's threatened by the Syrian civil war. And then Yemen, of course, is right next to Saudi Arabia, and we can't lose sight of that. And while I think it's a little bit too early to suggest that Yemen is destabilizing Saudi Arabia, it's certainly having a big impact on Saudi Arabia. It has dragged Saudi Arabia into it. The Saudis have embarked on a military operation the likes of which none of us have ever seen the Saudis engage in. It is not going terribly well for the Saudis. It is costing them billions of dollars that at this moment, with such low oil prices, they can ill afford. And it is helping to push them in the direction of very rapid economic reform, which at one level, some of the things that the Saudis are talking about are very smart, hopefully could be reasonable. At another level, a lot of it is badly undefined. It's not clear how they're going to negotiate all the obstacles in their own society to reform. And the speed at which they're going to try to do it, at least that they claim, that in and of itself is very dangerous. So both Yemen and Libya are already having an impact on the rest of the region. And so far, that's kind of at the benign end of the civil war spectrum.
That spillover is more of it in the Saudi Arabian sense of they are committing vast amounts of treasure and physical resources, or are the spillover effects because fighting literally spills over the border, or both?
It's a little of both, but it's mostly the former. Yes, there is fighting literally spilling over the border. The Houthi rebels have taken some pretty significant chunks of Saudi Arabia. But the truth is nobody really lives in those chunks of Saudi Arabia. That's not terribly meaningful. It has been humiliating for the Saudis. The Houthi fighters all seem to go into battle with GoPros on their heads. So if you go to YouTube, you can see these phenomenal videos of the Houthis fighting and killing all of these Saudis and inflicting humiliating defeats on the Saudis. That's not good for the Saudi government. But then beyond that, yes, it is sucking them in. It is creating an enormous economic cost at a moment when they really can't sustain it. As I said, it seems to be part of what is driving both this rapid economic reform that they're trying to pursue, and it's the rapid part that's dangerous, but it's also pushing them toward a much more aggressive, hardline foreign policy. Because the Saudi perspective is that the problems in Yemen are ultimately the cause of Iran, and it feeds into a meta-narrative that the Saudis seem to be cultivating, which is that Iran is at the heart of all the problems in the region. And certainly the Iranians are taking advantage of the problems and making them worse, but I think that it's incorrect to suggest that they're really at the heart of it and that somehow waging war against Iran across the region and defeating them is going to be the solution to the problems.
When we look at that level of turmoil, what is – you've written about how civil wars can be dampened, if not outright solved. There is a role for third parties in them, in some of them, under some conditions. What are some of those conditions, and which ones of these currently active civil wars is there perhaps a role either for the U.S. or the Western powers more broadly?
Sure. I'm going to be somewhat brief, and in being brief, I'm going to horribly oversimplify a vast, sophisticated academic literature on civil wars, and I hope that the authors of those studies will forgive me for doing so. When third parties have been successful intervening in civil wars, they've followed a fairly a fairly concise and consistent script. There are three basic things that you seem to need to do to shut down a civil war through a negotiated settlement. The first one is you've got to change the military dynamics such that all of the major players believe that they cannot win a military victory. And if they stop fighting and surrender their weapons, put down their weapons, they won't get slaughtered. Right? Those are critical military factors. And until you've got those military factors, nothing else matters, which is why I think that the American diplomatic efforts in Syria are premature at best, if not utterly misguided, because we've not created those circumstances. Second thing, you've got to broker a power-sharing agreement among all of the major factions in which all of the different communities receive political power and economic benefits commensurate with their demographic weight, so that there is a sense of fairness in the new power-sharing arrangement. And then the last piece, the piece that's actually the hardest, and the piece that the United States tends to mess up most frequently, is that you have to leave behind for some period of time institutions, external institutions like peacekeepers or internal institutions like a charismatic leader or an apolitical military that can guarantee the first two conditions for basically a generation, right? And it can be a symbolic move after the first year or two, but they've got to remain in place because really what you're looking to do is you have to rebuild trust among these different communities who've lost all trust in each other. And that takes about a generation to do.
It's quite a long time. Shadi, can I ask for your input there? You've talked a lot about the existential dilemma that a lot of these countries are going through post-Arab Spring, deciding what the democracy, if they do want to be a democracy, what they want their government to look like. Under those sorts of circumstances, when you're trying to build that from the ground up from countries that have been at war, what are some of the successful elements, or what are some of the elements that we're seeing in the Middle Eastern countries that are quasi holding on to some stability?
So I think one major lesson for me from the last few years is actually the opposite of what some people in D.C. think the lesson was, which is that external actors matter a lot. And there was this idea that we heard from President Obama and other senior officials in 2011 onwards. It's not about us as Americans, it's about them. And we have to kind of take a step back, and there isn't really much of a role that we as outsiders can play. But if you actually look at the six successful and or failed revolutions or stalled revolutions, five out of the six external actors play a significant or even decisive role. So if we look at Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria. The one exception is Tunisia, where outside actors didn't really play much of a role. But I would say Tunisia's the exception there because it's relatively remote. There aren't really vital national security interests at stake for most of the relevant actors. So the lesson there, I think, is it's also a question of which external actors. And when we step back,
what their intentions are.
Exactly. And so when we step back, others step in because there's a vacuum. And that's why I think the Obama administration's approach has been so counterproductive, because in theory, it sounds nice when you say, well, hey, regional actors, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar, whoever, it would be nice if they can rise to the responsibility and play some of this role on their own and lead and so on without the U.S. sort of being there every step of the way. But the problem is we have the misfortune of having not very constructive allies in the region. So they do actually take more responsibility for the region, but the results are not generally positive. And then there are cases like Syria, I think, where I think our allies have had the right idea to some extent in realizing that the Assad regime is at the source of the problem. And you can't defeat ISIS unless you address the problem of the Assad regime and its brutality against the Syrian people. But our allies don't have the capability militarily or politically to actually do what is necessary there. And I think I've been a proponent for quite some time of establishing no-fly zones, no-drive zones, and targeting the Assad regime militarily. We're not talking about some Iraq-style invasion. We're talking about – so that's always been a straw man. But, you know, in terms of, you know, not just focusing on ISIS, but also – and we were close to doing that in August 2013 where, you know, at the 11th hour – we backed down, and the French had their jets ready and so on. And that was a real opportunity, I think, that was lost. But I think the lesson there is, hey, you can't leave it up to your allies.
If I can jump in here, John, Chetty made a couple of points which I think are really worth emphasizing. And one point that I'd make is to tie the civil wars and the revolutions together, right? Because the revolutions that Chetty's been pointing to, you know, one of the things that we've seen, one of the ways that these external actors have played an unhelpful role is often in turning popular revolutions into civil wars, right? And in some cases, that was the goal of the regime itself. So Gaddafi, Assad, both of them tried, and arguably in Bahrain as well, the regime saw this popular revolt in all three of those countries. It was much more widespread. It really wasn't sectarian when it started out. And in every case, the regime's response was to go to its loyalists and say, this isn't a popular revolt. This is the other ethnic group, the other geographic group, the other religious group that's trying to overthrow us, and they want to slaughter all of us, right? And in a number of cases, we've had external actors who've come in to reinforce that message, right? With the Iranians coming into Syria, with the Saudis, unfortunately, coming into Bahrain. And so in every case, you know, Chetty and I can remember back to 2011, and we all, you know, Chetty in particular, knew lots of people who were participating in these events who they weren't from that ethnic group or religious group or geographic group. They just wanted a change in government. But unfortunately, the regime and these external actors pulled the rug out from under them, and they allowed. And now all anyone remembers is, oh, it's a, you know, it was always a Sunni Shia conflict in Syria. It was always East versus West, or Islamist versus secular in Libya. It was always Sunni versus Shia in Bahrain. That's not the case.
When it is the cases of external actors meddling, is it primarily along the Saudi Arabia-Iran divide, or are there other countries that are also bringing in influence in ways perhaps they shouldn't?
This sort of Saudi-Iran divide is the primary divide right now, but there are other complicating factors. And the one that we don't talk about as much now, because one side won in this sort of internal Arab cold and sometimes hot war, is between the pro-Islamist and anti-Islamist blocs, or to put it a little bit differently, pro-Muslim Brotherhood and anti-Muslim Brotherhood bloc. So on one side, you have Saudi Arabia and the UAE. On the other side, you have Turkey and Qatar. Those are the main players, at least. And the Muslim Brotherhood and its descendants and affiliates in the region, many of them, including, of course, the mother movement in Egypt, suffered pretty decisive defeats. And that changed the balance in the region, and Turkey and Qatar became more isolated. Now there's some shift in the sense that the Saudis no longer see the brother. They're not fans of the Brotherhood, and they won't be for the foreseeable future. But the Brotherhood is seen as less of a regional threat to the Saudis because they're weaker now, and that's why they've been able to refocus their attention on the primary worst enemy ever, Iran. And that's sort of what I think where a lot of the focus is now.
You know, it bears repeating for any American audience, you know, we are so obsessed with Daesh, with ISIS, right? That's all that we talk about. That's all that we care about. As Chetty's pointing out, in the region, I think the vast majority of people dislike, even detest Daesh. But for a lot of the governments, it's not the primary enemy, right? The Saudi government hates Daesh because Daesh wants to overthrow it. But the fact of the matter is, as Chetty just pointed out, on their kind of threat priority, it's Iran, top you know, with a bullet. And Daesh is on the list, but they are way, way down. And it's part of the disconnect that we have. When the United States comes in as one of these third parties, as one of these external actors, you know, we seem to a lot of these people like we're coming in out of fantasy land, because all we want to do is talk about Daesh. They see a different panoply of threats. And again, to go back to another point that Shadi made earlier, which is a really important one, at the end of the day, we need to remember that Daesh is more a product of the civil wars than it is a cause of them. And the way that we're behaving, we're treating it as if it is the cause. And the problem is, in places like Syria and Iraq, in particular Iraq, and potentially in Libya, you know, we are mounting these military campaigns to destroy Daesh. And we are not doing anything about the underlying civil wars. And the real danger there is, you know, we have a brilliant military. They may very well succeed in destroying Daesh. But the problem is, if we haven't dealt with the underlying problem, the civil wars, we'll have son of Daesh in those places, you know, a year later.
So when Ken says that, in a way it sounds so obvious, but that's what makes it more striking, that something as obvious as that isn't apparently obvious to a lot of people here in D.C., including in the government. And I worry that, you know, it should go without saying that you can't defeat ISIS without addressing the root causes that gave rise to ISIS in the first place. But the way we talk about counterterrorism in the U.S. media discourse, it's really narrow and security focused. It's how do we counter terrorism? It's not about the broader vision for the Middle East and addressing governance vacuums in large swaths of the Middle East, or even the bad word that we no longer talk about, the D word, democracy. The fact that U.S. support for democratic reform in the Middle East is not considered one of the ways to defeat ISIS and other extremist groups in the long run is remarkable to me. And the fact that we seem so disdainful as Americans sometimes of Arab priorities and even the priorities of our supposed friends or would-be friends, so the mainstream or moderate Syrian rebels, whatever you want to call them, when we're trying to train rebels and we tell them, hey, we know you actually hate the Assad regime more than ISIS, but we will kindly request of you to forget about the Assad regime for the foreseeable future and only focus on ISIS. First of all, I mean, it boggles the mind. It's so disrespectful to the people who are actually doing the fighting.
Counterproductive.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yes, right? Yes.
And at the end of the day, you know, we need to remember that the reason we have ISIS in Syria is because there's a civil war there. And the reason that we have a civil war there is because of the hideous, outrageous mismanagement of the Assad regime, right? And, you know, so in some ways, Shadi, what's even more galling, and I share your kind of astonishment at how Washington treats Syria, but even more stunning to me are the folks in Washington who then turn around and say, well, we're just going to have to back Assad. Right? Because he's the only solution to the problem of ISIS. No, the reason we've got ISIS in Syria is because of Assad.
You both have written about about this myopic security counterterrorism focus, both in terms of the U.S.'s approach to these states and within the states themselves, the authoritarian governments made, whether it was an illusory boogeyman of whoever the external threat is, or whether it was any sort of real threat. But everything was very sort of short-term security focused rather than focusing on developing governance, developing transparency, developing economic, developing their economies in ways beyond oil, perhaps. So what role is there for an external party in any of those aspects? Whether you want to presume that we achieve some sort of level of ceasefire in Syria or Libya, or whether you want to look at Egypt or maybe Jordan or some of the other countries that are, again, politically stable but are having issues.
So I think part of the problem is that the things that both Ken and I want, or how we want the U.S. to be more engaged and more involved, what that requires in practice, and we have to be honest about it, is a different kind of American role in the Middle East. It means committing considerable economic and political resources to this region of the world that a lot of Americans are quite frankly sick of, or at least they think they're sick of the Middle East, because that's also the sense they get from our politicians, and that sets the tone. So I think that's part of it as well. But, you know, there is this aspect of, again, it's a bad phrase, so I mean, nation building. That is part of what we have to help do in the Middle East, help these countries rebuild. But we can't do that on the cheap, and we can't do that with this kind of relative hands-off approach that the Obama administration has preferred now for the last almost 8 years. So I think we have to have an honest conversation in this country about what a lot of this means in practice. And And Ken wrote a great article in Foreign Affairs, I think, 2 years ago about building a Syrian rebel army and what that would require. And I liked how Ken actually came up with a price tag. I don't know if you'd modify that 2 years later, but if I recall,
it was inflation.
It was something like $3 to $10 billion a year annually for at least 2 to 5 years. Now, that might sound like a lot to the kind of ordinary American listener. But if we think that the Middle East is important to our national security interests and that what happens in the Middle East ultimately will affect us in some way, whether we want it to or not, then I think those numbers are actually ones that should be a realist. They should be seen as not crazy or unimaginable. They should be seen as what may be required to actually improve the state of affairs in the Middle East. But the fact that those numbers are not seriously discussed, I think, is part of the problem.
Let me add 2 points to the really lovely points that Shadi just made. First, you know, the flip side of what Shadi is saying, he's spot on about this, is that you have a lot of Americans, even American politicians and political leaders, will come forward and say, you know, we got to do more about the problems of the Middle East, right? And then you say, okay, well, you know, here's what a realistic plan would look like. This is, you know, exactly what Shadi is talking about. And what you hear from them is, ooh, you know, that sounds like too much, right? Well, okay, what are you willing to do? And the answer is kind of, well, I got $1.69 in my wallet. You know, how much Middle East stability will that buy me? And the answer is exactly that, not much, right? And so, you know, part of the problem is that a lot of our leaders are trying to go out to the American people and say to them, you know, we can solve the problems in the Middle East and it's only going to cost you $1.69. And as Shadi's pointing out, you know, it shouldn't be ruinously expensive. It doesn't have to cost as much as the Iraq War. It doesn't have to take as long as the Afghan War. But we have to be realistic about this, and we have to be honest with ourselves. And our leaders need to be honest with the American people in saying, look, we have very big problems in the region. They are affecting us. They have the potential to affect us in far worse ways. There are ways to handle them. They are not going to be enormously expensive. They're not going to be nothing. And, you know, the best piece of it, it's better to do this now and pay the costs now than try to pay the costs down the road when it will be horrendous, when it will be the cost of the Iraq War and the length of the Afghan War. Last point I wanted to make, put a positive spin on exactly this. It's worth keeping in mind that a lot of the folks in the region are also coming around, and a lot of our allies in Europe are also coming around. You know, I don't know about you, Shadi, but I've been really struck in the last 6 or 12 months how many places I've been in the region, in Europe, where Europeans have started talking about how, you know, the problems in the Middle East are really affecting Europe. They are wrecking the EU, the immigration, the terrorism. It is too, we need to do something. If you Americans will lead, we're willing to put real resources into following. That's a big change, a big advantage we haven't had in the past. And the second part is the changes in the region, where you have a recognition in their own way among many of the leaderships that, you know what, we actually do need to change. And again, Shadi and I have been writing about this stuff for 20 years and really getting very little traction, talking about the importance of political change, even using that D word that he mentioned, democracy, and having people tell us, forget about it, they don't want it, they're not willing to do any of this, talking about economic reform, social reform. Well, guess what? They're now talking about it themselves, right? Even Saudi Arabia, the most conservative of all societies. So far, they're not willing to talk about political or social change, but they are now interested in economic reform. And they're coming over here to the United States and saying, United States, we need your help. You know, exactly where your question started us, Adriana. You know, they want our help. And that creates an opportunity for us to then go to them and say, great, we'd be glad to help you, but here's what we need from you too.
I'm glad you brought that up, Ken, because that was going to be one of my main questions, was that when we talk about U.S. involvement in the region, we talk about whether the U.S. is willing to commit the kind of resources that we're talking about. How much is our help wanted? It's a lot of times, I feel like a lot of times the U.S. hangs back because if, for instance, if some country's having an election, we say we like that guy, then that guy's opponents are going to jump all over him and go, great, you're a tool of the U.S., the Zionists. You know, the U.S. is not unjustifiably looked on with some suspicion in the region. If we were willing to commit those resources, where is that welcome and what shape do you think our assistance would be welcomed?
I'll start with two specific points and then I'm going to turn it over to Shadi to make some bigger picture comments. First, just a follow up. A little bit on my point. You know, Shadi and I have both been very critical of the Obama administration. You know, we think that this idea of disengagement has been very counterproductive to the Middle East, and I think that the evidence speaks for itself. That said, worth giving them credit for this. The disengagement that they have engaged in over the last 7 years has terrified the folks in the Middle East. And we are now welcomed and desired and wanted in ways that we really weren't before Barack Obama came to office. And so in that sense, I think that he has actually set up the next administration very nicely, because a lot of people who were saying, you know, get out of here, we don't want you, you wreck everything, yeah, you're tied to the Israelis or this or that, they're now all saying, where are you? Why are you not here? You know, how dare you walk away and leave us in chaos? And I think so in that sense, again, it's a very positive development. The second point that I'd make is that obviously every country, in some ways every country of the Middle East has a similar set of problems, a broad set of problems, exactly what Shadi was referring to earlier, exactly what his new book treats with. But of course, every country also has specific issues, and every country is likely to follow a somewhat different path toward reform, depending on how rich or how poor they are, you know, what their status is, whether they're in civil war or close to. There are a lot of different paths. And I think that part of how the United States needs to start re-engaging with the region is having a series of conversations with the people over there who are looking to change, and the governments who are now realizing, you know what, guys, the status quo isn't going to hold, and we better make at least some changes. And I think we're going to have conversations with each of them about, you know, what would you like to do? Here's what we think that you need to do. Here's where we can play a role. Here's where the Europeans can play a role, or the World Bank or the IMF. And we're going to need to tailor approaches to each of these countries, even while we recognize that all of them are going to have to have some answer to solving these big picture problems that Shadi's talking about.
And I would just add, so, you know, on your point about this sort of the tainting effect of U.S. support, anti-Americanism is at extremely high levels, even under Obama. It's not as if Obama has really changed that situation. But people can be very anti-American in the sense that they hate U.S. policy, as obviously many people in the Middle East do. But that doesn't mean they don't believe in some way that the U.S. can be better or do better. And I remember that, you know, in the early years of the Obama administration, I would hear hints of Bush nostalgia from unlikely quarters, including the Muslim Brotherhood and other Islamist groups. They were almost like the good old days when at least Bush, for that brief period in 2004, 2005, where he was emphasizing democracy promotion, and not just Islamists, obviously, but, you know, liberals, secularists. I remember there was a moment, and I was living in Jordan at the time in 2004, 2005. We forget it now, but there was a kind of optimism there, and it was even called we don't call this anymore, but the first Arab Spring, 2004, 2005, and so on. Anyway, but another kind of broader issue here, we've talked a lot about interests and resources and price tags, but let's also not forget that there's a very strong moral component to this. It's really about who we are as a nation, as Americans. And it also affects our very close allies, the Europeans. And for them, it's actually existential, where refugee flows and the threat of terrorism and Western foreign fighters who go and come back and so on, all of these things are threatening the social fabric of European countries in ways that provides an opening for populist xenophobic leaders. And I should say, obviously, it's not only a problem in Europe because we have our own populist xenophobic presidential candidate. So we have to be a little bit more open to seeing how these things are, in a way, endlessly intertwined. There is no such thing as containing the Middle East. That is, I think, an important lesson. So we should just kind of scrap that. We can just keep it there and it won't come back to haunt us in some way. And I mean, I'm also, you know, part of the way that I see this too is, you know, I'm a child of immigrants. My parents grew up under an authoritarian regime. And part of what I always felt it meant to be American was that we believed in certain things and that we wouldn't be willing to stand by silently as more than 400,000 people are killed in a place like Syria. I mean, that to me is just morally indefensible. And I think it really calls into question the entirety of the international order as we know it. Do I want to live in a world as an American where almost half a million people can be killed and then we just go around and talk about an endless diplomatic process that doesn't actually do anything for 5 years straight? And that to me, so there's this kind of where's our emotion, where's our passion, and the fact that we can have a president who is brilliant, and I'll acknowledge that, but seems so dispassionate about the fact that the world around us seems to be crumbling, at least for Arabs living in the region, that he doesn't seem to really feel that. I mean, that to me is concerning.
I have one last question for the both of you, and then if you have any closing remarks or sum-ups you'd like to give. Because it's an election year, I did want to ask about – we often talk about foreign policy in terms of the presidency. State Department is executive branch. But if we're talking about – particularly about committing troops anywhere to Syria or anywhere else, how much of what you might like to see done can be done by the president and the State Department and DOD alone, and how much – at what point might Congress need to be involved? Does what you're thinking about require an authorization for use of military force or anything else like that?
I will start by saying I served about a dozen years in the executive branch, and I've always been a very firm believer that you want to have the Congress on board with any major foreign policy endeavor. I think that we probably will need some degree of American force, and we've already got 5,000 troops in Iraq. We've got a number of special forces operatives and others in Syria. I suspect it would require somewhat more to properly deal with Iraq, properly deal with Syria, let alone Libya, Yemen, both of which I think are better handled by Europeans and regional states. But nevertheless, we'd need to be contributing as well. But beyond that, as Shadi was pointing out before, it also is about a major diplomatic effort, and it also will require some additional commitment of economic assistance. This is a big project. Even if we don't deploy 100,000 troops, it's still a big project. And I think that we will be much better served having the Congress on board. I will also say that I don't think that that folks who just dismiss and say, oh, the Congress will never do this, the American people. You know, the polls have actually been very consistent in showing that the American people believe that the government should be doing more in the Middle East, including committing ground troops in both Syria and Iraq. And I think that the Congress is also amenable to it. I think that people make the mistake in believing that what happened in 2013 was that the Congress was against the use of force. My conversations with congressmen and senators at the time, and they were very extensive, were that those who opposed it because they felt that the administration was just going to do a one-off, lob a bunch of cruise missiles at a bunch of targets in Syria. And unfortunately, some of the most senior administration representatives were saying that's all they were going to do. And the Congress's response was, that makes no sense. put a real serious strategy in front of us, and we will support that. But if you just want to do a feel-good cruise missile pinprick, no, that doesn't make any sense to us. So again, I think the opportunity is there for the next president if she wants to do it, right? I don't know if she will. I don't know exactly where she's going to come down on this. And I recognize that she's going to have a lot of different priorities out there. And I'm using the female pronoun, but I recognize it may be a he. So the next president, may have other priorities. But, you know, if she comes to Shadi and myself, you know, what we're going to say is, look, the possibilities are out there. This does not have to be a break the bank kind of a proposition. But don't go into it thinking this is going to be quick and easy and a whiff of grape shot, as the British used to say, is going to solve the problem. But if you're committed and you're realistic, I think that you can build both the domestic support and a real international coalition to help do this.
So I think presidential leadership is really critical here. And it's just bothered me endlessly when you know, you hear people essentially making the argument that Obama is basically just being responsive to public opinion and that, you know, he has to be respectful of this is where the American people are and all of that. I find that to be a little bit of a disingenuous argument because it's very clear that Obama believes in what he's doing. He doesn't need public opinion to tell him one way or the other. And let's say hypothetically that public opinion and public opinion, as Ken has said, is actually a bit more mixed on the question of intervention. But let's say, you know, 70% of the American people were fine targeting the Assad regime. It seems to me that Obama would still pretty much have the position he has now. This is something that he feels. He is very suspicious of American military involvement in the Middle East for a number of reasons. But, you know, so I think it's this public opinion thing has been it's sort of been used as a convenient excuse for things that this administration would have done regardless. I think if Obama was more serious about reengaging and leadership in the Middle East, then he would have to make the case to the American people, and he can be persuasive if he wants to be. And this is where the president has to set the tone for American public opinion. On the other hand, when Obama has said things which I think contributes to this sense of disenchantment that Americans have with the words Middle East, when he says things like in his State of the Union address where he referred to millennia-old conflict, so kind of buying into this ancient hatreds thesis, which very few people who actually know the Middle East actually would ever buy into. It's a very problematic argument. And there's a sense that he just sees this as look at these problematic Arabs and Muslims just fighting with each other and look how tribal they are. And he actually uses this term tribal and tribalism in the famous Jeffrey Goldberg profile in The Atlantic. And you get this sense that he has a contempt and disdain to some extent for the people of the region, that they're so aroused by the passions of ideology, religion, ethnic divide, sectarianism. Obama doesn't think in those terms. Obama sees himself as a kind of self-styled rationalist technocrat. That's why he loves hanging out with Asian technocrats. And he actually makes this pretty clear in the Jeffrey Goldberg profile that he would just rather be meeting and talking about, you know, economic tinkering and things like that. Look, I get it. That's who Obama is. But I feel like his unwillingness to really empathize with other approaches to understanding the Middle East that take religion and ideology and the emotions of politics seriously, I think that's been a real hindrance.
Thank you. Do either of you have any last thoughts?
I'll just, I think, wrap up. Again, playing off of Shadi's point that, you know, I think the point that the two of us have both been making in our time today and for many years previously is, you know, the Middle East is a deeply problematic region, no question about that, but it's not going to go away. We can't ignore it, right? The United States has been trying to ignore the Middle East for 50 years, and it has never worked. There's too much at stake there. It has too many impacts. And I think that, you know, the question really is, at what point in time do we recognize that there is an opportunity, because the people of the region and our allies elsewhere have all come around to this recognition that the Middle East is affecting the rest of the world. And that's a great thing, and it creates an opportunity, but we need to recognize that the Middle East won't fix itself, and even our European and East Asian allies can't fix it for them without our participation, without our leadership. That's the role of the United States. And it doesn't mean that we need to do it all ourselves, and it doesn't mean that we need to pay for it all of ourselves, but it does mean that we need to lead the effort.
Gentlemen, thank you both very much for joining me today. We went a little long, but I appreciate you playing along. I encourage our listeners to go to brookings.edu to find the rest of their work, and you can email us with any questions or thoughts at intersections@brookings.edu.
Thanks
thank
a lot.
You.
Thank you, Adriana.